What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another fun-filled episode of Between the Tackles. As always, we are on the social media platforms, at Tackles Pod, wherever you get it, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Be sure to check it out. Like, subscribe, download wherever you can if you want more from me and my good pal, Manish. Manish, we're at it again. How are you doing today, man?
I'm doing great, and I'm especially doing great because we have the honor of having John McClain join us. John McClain will be covering his 50th training camp later this year, a member of the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, recognized by the Pro Football Writers Association and the Pro Football Hall of Fame many, many years ago for his outstanding work covering the league, really a legend in this business, still does radio, TV, and podcasts in the Texas area. Also one of the most genuinely nice human beings you'll ever come across. So I'm excited about this show. So welcome, John. Really happy to have you.
Thank you very much, Manish. I appreciate you having me on.
We will get into some of the Texans stuff a little bit later. I did want to, right off the top, talk about this documentary that you were a part of. It is Black History Month, and recently your documentary got released. It's called the PVIL, Separate But Equal, with a question mark at the end of it. PVIL is Prairie View Interscholastic League, essentially chronicling the segregated leagues in Texas in the 1920s through 1970, I believe. But I wanted to get into some specifics about the documentary, which is fantastic. You can find that documentary on maddogentertainment.tv. And believe me, if you're a football buff, a history buff, civil rights buff, you are going to absolutely love this podcast because it's got so many great stories that I think most of us have not heard of. A lot of recognizable names in the documentary, like Jimmy Johnson, Warren Moon, Eric Dickerson, Mean Joe Green, and many more. I just thought it was a fascinating story. So initially, John, I wanted to ask you how the documentary came about and kind of how you guys and the other producers, you know, pieced together how you wanted to tell this story about the PVIL.
After the Texans lost at Kansas City in the divisional round after the 24th season, I said I was going to take a couple of months off from writing, which I've never done. I've been in this business now 54 and a half years. So I thought I'd take couple of weeks, then a month, then 2 months. And I said, I ain't writing anything again. I'll just do the broadcast stuff. And I had worked with a director, Mark Burns, on a documentary about the Phillips family, Bum, Wade, and West, the Vikings offensive coordinator. And when we finished that, Mark Burns and one of the producers, Rob Lance, was like, well, what do we do next? And I was, because we'd had so much fun working on that. We interviewed like 60 people. And so I said, the Old Southwest Conference. I said, if we don't do something on the Old Southwest Conference, people are going to forget about it. And Rob Lynch goes, well, what about the PVIL? And I said, what about it? And he told me two or three stories. And I said, where'd you hear that? He said, from Joe Green and Kenny Houston. Joe, who lives in the Dallas area, and Kenny lives here. You know, they were both first ballot Hall of Famers and they're brothers-in-laws. So I thought, wow, next time Joe comes down here, let's go to lunch and talk to him about it. So we did. And I was like, you're right. We got to do the Prairie View Interscholastic League, the all-black high school organization that operate independently of the all-white University Interscholastic League. And I grew up in Waco, Texas, which is about an hour and a half from Dallas in Central Texas. And we had a school in the PVIL that won three state championships. And I knew it, never knew it, because the media gave absolutely no coverage to the Prairie View Interscholastic League. And we started looking through it. There's Hall of Famers in there. They're like so many great players like Joe Green and Kenny Houston. And they're still around. All those guys are like 80, 82, 83. Emmett Thomas is the other Hall of Famer who's still alive. So we got an executive producer, Scott Nethery, and the four of us decided we're not doing any Zooms. So we went to Canton. We went to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. We went all over Texas interviewing people. We got pictures. We got articles. We got it was amazing how many things we were able to get. And in the story of the first integrated state championship in Texas, Johnny Rowland, who was a great running back at Corpus Christi Miller. And Johnny, they went 13-1. They integrated in the 50s when they were supposed to. The rest of Texas did not. South didn't integrate when it was supposed to in the 50s. So they played, went 13-1, didn't play another team with a black player. They had five black players led by Johnny Rowland. And their coach is 98 years old, still going strong. We went out to Lubbock in West Texas, interviewed him. He told us all about what they went through, playing all white teams all over the state. And then he said, you know, we beat Wichita Falls in the final, but that wasn't the best team we played. Who was the best team? The semifinals, we beat Port Arthur Jefferson 6-0. Johnny scored on a long touchdown. And he said, the best player we played was a little nose guard. And he was like a Wolverine. He just attacked everything. And we're like, yeah, I'm kind of getting bored. And I said, who was it? It was Jimmy Johnson. And I perked up. I knew Jimmy went to Port Arthur Jefferson over in what we call Golden Triangle, about an hour from Houston in East Texas, close to Louisiana. So we called Jimmy and told him we'd like to come interview him. And he goes, I can't remember last week or last month. And then he thought about it. And I guess the memories kept flooding back. So he said, come on. So the four of us went to Key Largo, Florida. We spent a day in his big Jimmy Johnson's Big Chill sports bar and grill on the water. We interviewed him. He regaled us with stories about the PVIL in that season and the times, but also about the Herschel Walker trade and all kind of great stories. And we didn't want to leave. But we had a blast doing that, traveling around the state. And right now, guys, what we have is on that maddogentertainment.tv is what's called the director's cut. We had a premiere 2 weeks ago. There were 370 people there, media, players, former players came to support us, coaches like Wade Phillips and Gary Kubiak. And then the director edited it to what's called the final cut on that site. At some point, will be a longer director's cut. And at some point, we're going to divide it up into four 42-minute segments in which you get more stories like Jimmy Johnson and Johnny Rowland. So it was a labor of love. Been getting a lot of great attention around the country. Producers are working on streaming rights. They're working on networks, PBS, and theaters. And all I did was do the interviews and then try to help promote it. And I had the easiest job. But some of the things in there, it's powerful, it's gut-wrenching, it's heart-tugging. In one of the pictures we have, Mansfield High School outside Fort Worth was supposed to integrate. They didn't want to integrate. The governor didn't want them to integrate. So he called in the Texas Rangers. Texas Rangers, we have pictures of them outside the entrance to Mansfield High School, yucking it up with all the Mansfield students, and above them, hanging from the top steeple of the entrance to the school, is a black dummy with a noose around its neck. And that was supposed to deter black kids from coming to school, and it did.
It's interesting, John, to circle back real quick to Jimmy Johnson. What I thought was fascinating, what Jimmy said without giving away too much, is that he didn't think when he was playing a team that had black players, it wasn't particularly shocking for him, because when he was growing up as an 8, 9, 10-year-old kid, there was a park, he said, across the street from his home, and they would play tackle football, no pads, you know, just kids playing tackle football, white kids, black kids, Hispanic kids. So he never really thought much about it. But what I thought was really fascinating was that you talked about Texas being a little slow to integrate, and I think across myriad areas that was true. But for sports specifically, you know, anybody who understands American history knows that in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education desegregated public schools. But then you look at how long the PVIL was still in operation. They didn't disband until 1970. So it wasn't an elixir you know, Thurgood Marshall was the attorney for the NAACP that won this landmark case. But people in Texas, including, you know, principals and politicians, they were like, okay, well, this is supposedly going to go into law, but we're going to take our time to do this. So in effect, there was still segregation, you know, in high school sports in Texas. So I wanted to get your thoughts on it. Just, you know, what was that like when you talked to players who specifically, you know, were in the PVIL after Brown versus Board of Education, still being, you know, segregated?
Almost all of Texas and all across the South just ignored it. And it wasn't until LBJ passed the Civil Rights Act in 64 when they said, we better get our butts in gear. And it still took them 6 years to comply totally where the UIL could absorb the PVIL. And the thing that gets me, no player we interviewed, not Joe Green, Kenny Houston, Jerry Levias, the first Black to get a scholarship in the Southwest Conference at SMU in 65, not Johnny Rowland, who couldn't go in the Southwest Conference and had to go to Missouri. They're not bitter. I told them, I said, I'm bitter. This pisses me off. And they said, we didn't think anything about it. We knew there was an all-white organization that had their league. We just assumed we were better. We got inferior equipment, hand-me-downs. And the scene in the first where the kid number 75 getting rained on as a reenactment of Joe Green, because he told us when he was in high school at Temple Dunbar in Central Texas, they could use the white stadium but not the locker rooms because they were Black. So they would have to have pregame and halftime in the end zones. And sometime it'd be pouring rain, and they're trying to hear the coaches trying to yell out over the thunder and lightning. And that's what that opening scene is. We had four reenactments we did. And but it wasn't LBJ, the LBJ Library. They want us to have a screening there. So does the Pro Football Hall of Fame, Texas Sports Hall of Fame, the Texas A&M's George Bush Library wants to have one. We showed it in one of the biggest suburban high schools in Texas this week. A lot of high schools want us to see it, and there's almost like not enough hours in the day. But we think it's imperative that high school, maybe middle school kids today, see it so they can see what happened. Not just the Black kids, but the white kids too. But these guys are not bitter. I'm bitter. I'm embarrassed and I'm ashamed, but they're not.
You know what's interesting to me is that despite all the disadvantages that the players and the teams had, there was this powerful sense of community. And I think that one of the stories that is shared in this documentary, you know, resonates with me, is that for night practices, the community, whether it was coaches, just people in the neighborhood, parents of players, they would line up maybe 25, 30 cars and turn on their headlights so that the field could have lights for the kids to practice on. And, you know, I just think that to me, things like stories like that really are fascinating to me, because it would have been easy, as you touched on, for these guys to be angry or bitter and think, well, why aren't we getting the same privileges that you know, the white kids are getting? But for as little as they had as a community, they really rallied around each other to make and foster an environment for these kids so they could, you know, enjoy themselves playing football.
When Joe Green went to college at North Texas State in Denton, Texas, up by the Oklahoma border, first practice, somebody walked up and handed him a cup. He said, what's this? It's water. What do I want to do with water? You're supposed to drink it. You need to drink it. I've never had water at practice. We have water at practice. And they said, yeah, we want you to drink a lot of it. So he's like, he never thought about it. Then when he was about to play his first game, they told him, get up on this table. Why? We're going to tape your ankles. Why? I don't want my ankles taped. They've never been taped. Coach says, do it. So Joe got off. He was walking like he was on the moon, very gingerly. And then he saw how good they felt. And then he says, man, I'm going to be even quicker and faster. And he was. And things like that, they never thought about. Kenny Houston, first ballot Hall of Famer in 86. Kenny went to Lufkin up in East Texas, Piney Woods. And nobody let him use the bathroom. No, as he said, filling stations wouldn't let him use it. So that when enough of them had to go on their way to a game in a rickety old bus, they'd tell the driver, and he'd turn down some dirt road and go into the woods, and he'd open the door and tell them, make sure you take your toilet paper. And then they would come back, get on the bus, and go play football. And those are things we can't imagine, kids can't imagine today, and they didn't think anything about it. Elmo Wright, who invented the end zone dance, Elmo was from a town called Sweeney, Texas, in Southeast Texas. And as a junior in high school, he was at the all-black school. He led them to a state championship. And he said the next year, they said, oh, you need to go across the tracks to the all-white Sweeney High School. Oh, okay. Said he felt like he was going off to college. And he led them to a state championship, back-to-back black and white state championships. And he just kind of shrugged his shoulders about it, didn't think it was any big deal. And that's the way they all are. And I tell you what, I am so proud to have worked on this. It's just a minor role. But, man, getting to ask them those questions for literally hours and hours and hours. And they were happy to talk to it. I asked Kenny Houston early on, do you think it's weird that four old white guys are doing what we hope is the definitive documentary on black high school football in Texas? And he goes, yeah, it's weird, but I can't think of anybody I'd rather see do it.
Great. I think I haven't personally watched the documentary yet. I did watch a little bit about you talking about it, and some of the stuff that stood out to me most that really kind of grasped my interest with this is the story, first off, about Eldridge Dickey. He's somebody that I have never heard of him. I'm a 36, almost 37-year-old guy from the Northeast, so my exposure to Texas high school football was Friday Night Lights. That is about as far into it as I've gotten. But hearing the story of Eldridge Dickey from you and about the influence he had on Warren Moon in his career was fascinating. I'm looking forward to seeing a lot more in depth on that storyline. And also the Turkey Day Classic, how involved it was with the community. Like, I think about like where I grew up, I'm like, we have nothing like that up here that kind of really brought that community together. So I'm really fascinated to see all that.
The story about Eldridge Dickey, I was telling Warren Moon about 8 months ago about what we were doing. He said, you know who Eldridge Dickey was? I said, of course we do. He was the greatest PVIO quarterback. The Lord's Prayer was his nickname. He could throw it 60 yards on a line drive. You could hang clothes on with either arm. And he went to Tennessee State so he could play for John Merritt and throw the ball after going to Booker T. Washington here. And Moon was a kid, and he liked to look at magazines every week about football. And he saw a story in Sport Magazine about the greatest quarterback nobody knows about, Eldridge Dickey, at Tennessee State, which was Tennessee, I think, A&T back then. And so he started looking at Eldridge Dickey's stats in the sporting news every week, and he decided, I'm Eldridge Dickey. In the yard, playground, he was always Eldridge Dickey. Nobody knew who that was. And Warren's favorite team growing up was Oakland. In 1968, Al Davis made Eldridge Dickey the first black quarterback drafted in the first round. And Warren said, we all thought we finally have a guy who could, a black quarterback in the NFL, who will show the owners, the general managers, and the coaches that a black man can play quarterback. But as soon as Al Davis drafted him, he moved him to receiver and special teams. He never threw a pass. And the reason he drafted him was keep him away from Hank Stram. He found out Stram was secretly scouting Eldridge Dickey, and Stram needed a quarterback. Stram picked ahead of Davis, but he didn't need to take Dickey in the first round because black quarterbacks didn't get drafted in the first round. So he took him, and then they took Kenny Stabler in the second round, even though they had MVP Daryl LaMonica and George Blanda, who was still the backup. And Dickey, it just crushed him. It ruined him. One of his teammates, Alphonse Dotson, Santana Dotson's daddy, we went out in West Texas. He owns a winery, and he talked about what it was like for Dickey never getting a chance to play quarterback, and they never had any intention of it. And so it was a sad tale. He ended up, something he did I've never seen anywhere, and I have not found a player told me they have either. They played a game against Kansas City, a preseason game in Birmingham, and Blanda didn't want to go. He's too ornery. LaMonica wasn't going to play because they had six preseason games. Stabler was in a commune or something. He hadn't even signed, so they told Dickey, you're going to play against the Chiefs. He had such a great game that after the game was over, the Chiefs' two defensive tackles, Buck Buchanan and Ernie Ladd, picked him up and carried him off the field. Opposing players, they took him over to the tunnel going to the Raiders locker room, and I talked to his favorite receiver at Tennessee State, who was playing for the Chiefs then, Nolan the Nat Smith, and he confirmed it. So did Alphonse Dodson. And nobody ever seen that, and it was the only chance he ever got to play quarterback, and it was he died a broken, lonely man here in 2000, and it's just such a sad story about Eldridge Dickey.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I was watching that, obviously I'd never heard of a player being carried off from the other team, and I believe in that game he rallied the Raiders, but they fell just short at the end of the game. I wanted to ask you, John, I mean, look, you've seen – so many different iterations of the NFL, 70s, 80s, 90s, and so on and so forth. Was it unusual for a team to draft two quarterbacks in the first two rounds? Because obviously, look, Kenny Stabler, Hall of Famer, won a Super Bowl, excellent player from a powerhouse program. I'm curious, was Al Davis an outlier in that respect, drafting two quarterbacks in the first and second round? Because I can recall Mike Shanahan drafting Robert Griffin in the first round and then Kirk Cousins in the fourth. But, back-to-back rounds, first two rounds, quarterbacks, has that ever happened, from your knowledge?
Not that I know of. The Houston Oilers drafted Dan Pastorini, third overall, and then Lynn Dickey, I think, in the fifth round. It's happened before when you draft two. Redskins did it one year with Gus Frerotte coming after Heath Shuler. But in this case, he only took him to keep him away from Stram.
Okay.
And Stram was looking for a good backup. George Blanda, I guess they drafted Stabler because LaMonica was coming off an MVP season, but George was getting old. He'd been a great player with the Oilers in the early 60s, and they were looking for a backup thinking it might be Stabler. But he was drafted in 68 and didn't play for him in the 70s. He's in a hippie commune. He played for a minor league team. He couldn't get the money he wanted. And he told me when he was there in 80 that Blanda called him and said, son, you need to get in here and take this money. You're not going to play, but that's good because that's going to add time on the end of your career when you're making a lot of money if you're half as good as you think you are. And so that's what happened. When he played here in 80, he was the highest paid player, $300,000 a year. And Stram ended up taking some guy, I think his name was Mike Richardson, who never panned out. And Stram said it was criminal what Al Davis and the Raiders did to Eldridge Dickey. And Alphonse Dodson kind of disputes that. And Alphonse got teary-eyed when he was talking about Dickey. I said, Alphonse, why are you getting emotional talking about this? And he said, because we thought he was the one, just like Warren Moon thought he was the one, and he never got a chance to prove that he could play in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible story. It's one of many incredible stories in this documentary. It's the PVIL story, separate but equal, maddogentertainment.tv. I cannot wait to see the director's cut. I've seen the released version now. And if, like I said earlier, if you love football, you love history, this is just a tremendously insightful piece. And it's gripping and, as you mentioned earlier, gut-wrenching at times, powerful, throughout, and just a wonderful story that I'm glad you and others had an opportunity to share. So please, if you get an opportunity, check that out. It's unlike many documentaries you'll see about football. It's not about one team. It's not about one person. It's about an era and some might say an ugly era in American history. Some might say ultimately the resolution was that there was integration. And, things, worked out even for, guys who did not have a lot of the advantages that the white players did. And the fact that there are seven Pro Football Hall of Fame players that came from the PVIL, tells you a lot about just what that organization and what that league was all about at a very difficult time in American history. So just check it out.
Thank you very much. Let me tell you one quick thing. Gene Upshaw is on the all-time PVIL team, and they still have a website, and they have a president. They have reunions, and we discovered Gene who is from Robstown down close to Corpus. He never played in the PVIO because little old Robstown integrated when Corpus did. So his whole playing career at Robstown was in the all-white UIL, even though he was probably the only black player. And so we told him, you guys need to get Gene out of there. And they said, we think it's too late.
That's interesting.
I'm sorry. This is a great story, guys. When Joe Green, he wanted to go to the Cowboys, his hero was Bob Lilly. He wanted to play with Lilly. Can you imagine the Cowboys with Lilly and Joe Green? So the biggest small school at that time was Texas A&I, now University of Texas, Kingsville. And Gene Upshaw was their best player. So Joe Green went down on a recruiting trip, and the coach told Joe that Gene was going to show him a good time. And he had him in there, and he told Gene, I want you to take this guy around. I want you to show him a good time because we want him. So he gave Gene $5. Gene stops at a 7-Eleven, goes inside, comes out, hands Joe Green 50 cents, tells him, get out of the car, have a good time. And Gene drove off, and Joe went to North Texas State.
Well, hey, the Steelers are thankful for that, for sure. Who knows? There may have never been a Steelers Cowboys rivalry if Green was on the Cowboys. Maybe they would have dominated. But great stories, John. I do want to talk about the Texans. Obviously, you've covered them a very long time from the very beginning. They've had gone through some tough times. This year, I think, was kind of a throwback year when you look at how teams are constructed, really defensive first-minded team. I thought that they had a legit pathway to the Super Bowl. It ultimately didn't happen, and we can get into details about why in a second. But just as a big picture, the state of the franchise now versus even 4 or 5 years ago when they seemed like they were in disarray, I think that Nick Caserio has done a really good job. I want to get your thoughts on the state of the Texans entering the 2026 season.
They'd been terrible when D'Amico Ryans was hired in time for the 2023 season. He turned them around immediately. They won the division, won a playoff game, lost at Baltimore in the divisional round. Next year, they won the division, and they won a playoff game, and they lost by 8 at Kansas City. And C.J. Stroud played really well. Then this year, they start 0-3, and I'm thinking, well, they're going to get a high draft choice, and then they win 11 in a row, and they won the playoff game at Pittsburgh, and then Stroud picked the worst time in his career to have the worst game of his career. And so they've got a great defense. They gave up 17 a game, just like Seattle, and if they hadn't pulled the starters in the last game against Indy and given up several trash touchdowns, they would have been number one in points and yards. They got all their players back on defense that they want, and their defense should be great again. Matt Burke, their defensive coordinator, has done a tremendous job. D'Amico Ryans turned over the calls to him. And as you were right about Nick Caserio doing a good job, except for his offensive line. He has stunk it up drafting offensive linemen. And they need to, at first you don't succeed, try again. If second you don't succeed, try again. Third you don't succeed. That is their key because – they couldn't run block this year. They didn't have a running game, mediocre at best. So they got to give Stroud a running game, and they got to give him better protection. And if the game against the Patriots was a sign of what's to come, and I certainly don't believe it is, so he didn't have a fumble all year, did not lose one fumble till the playoffs. He only threw 8 interceptions during the season. So I think they'll be able to bounce back. But I'll tell you guys, I never used Texans and Super Bowl in the same sentence at any point the last 3 seasons because they've never gotten beyond the divisional round. And when they prove to me they can get beyond the divisional round, that's when I'll use Texans and Super Bowl in the same sentence.
Now, John, look, CJ, CJ Stroud has become a polarizing figure. He played pretty well as a rookie, number 2 overall pick. There has been some amount of regression since that rookie year. And for better or for worse, there have been discussions among fans among the general public that perhaps the Texans would be better off trading him. And you have been very outspoken recently about the notion of trading C.J. Stroud. In fact, you made a relatively bold proclamation if C.J. Stroud were to be traded. So how do you feel about this?
Well, first of all, people that talked about him not being as good in his second year as his first didn't point out that Stephon Diggs missed half the season, Tank Dell missed half the season, Nico Collins, their best receiver, missed five games. So that was their top three receivers who he didn't have even close to a full season. And they had a better running game, but the offensive line was utterly pathetic. They led the league in players getting beat at the snap of the ball. And so I don't care who it is, Patrick Mahomes getting sacked eight times, you know, anybody, you're going to start to feel it. And then last year, he didn't play as well. He didn't have big games where he threw four or five touchdowns. He didn't have to bring them from behind to win a lot of games. And he was fine. Sometimes he was real good. Sometimes he was mediocre, but they kept winning primarily because of their defense. And so I saw this week that a couple of national outlets and then fans jumped all over it here talking about, one of them said they're hearing your ready to move on from Davis Mills. And I'm like, my God, are you kidding me? Davis Mills, they're going to trade Stroud, go with Mills. Do you have a clue? So I just put out there, it ain't happening. He's not being traded, and Mills is not being elevated. And I noticed later, and I don't usually look at this, at 87,000-something retweets. And I'm like, well, let's see. What, even though I don't have to get clicks anymore. But I looked, okay, what could I do? Let's see, in 2014, I said I'd eat the sports section if the Texans didn't draft a quarterback. And I had to eat strips of the Chronicle sports section when they drafted Jadeveon Clowney. And so I said, okay, this is what I typed. I said, if C.J. Stroud gets traded, I'll walk down, start to say jog now, start to say no. I'd be lucky to drive, but I said, I'll walk naked down Kirby Drive, which is the main artery, by NRG Stadium in 5 o'clock rush hour traffic. And so I started getting all these calls from radio stations. It's just like when Belichick didn't make the Hall, I had 19 stations call me over 2 days. And I said, guys, I'll be happy to talk to you, but I want to promote a documentary for 1 minute. So all but two let me do it. So in this case, I looked, and after about 6 hours, it was almost 400,000 retweets. And now I'm thinking, if he gets traded, I may get a million. People be paying me not to do that. As I told a friend of mine, did a story in the Chronicle's website. I said, if I do that at 5 o'clock, there'll be no traffic on Kirby Drive.
Now, honestly, we're just talking amongst friends here. Would you actually follow through with this if he were traded?
First of all, I'd get arrested if I tried something like that, because that's one of the busiest streets in town. It would cause wrecks because people would shield their eyes, or they would put bags over their heads so they didn't see me, and they'd have wrecks. And I'd get charged with no telling. I'd be going straight to jail. Somebody told me, well, you could wear a towel. Well, that's not what I said. I said naked. So, I hope he doesn't get traded. I can't imagine what they're going to do, trade him to the Jets for Justin Fields. And that's the thing. He's been in the playoffs 3 years in a row. He's won a playoff game, and a lot of teams would like to have a guy like that. And I don't think they'll extend him this offseason. They should not. Pick up the fifth-year option, extend him if he plays well next year. Will Anderson Jr. is the one that's earned every penny of his extension, and he'll be probably the highest-paid defensive player in NFL history.
Just to put a bow on this here, because I really need to know this. What does your wife think about it?
She thinks that let's see how she put it. I've stooped beneath myself by tweeting that, and that would be really low for me to go, considering. I guess what she told me, I do things like that. And she can't believe I still do them. And she doesn't care about the internet. She doesn't care about clicks. I said, it's funny. I said, I've been getting all kind of pub on eating the newspaper. She said, well, do you know what a fool you look like? I said, I see a lot of people say if the team wins and loses, they'll quit their job, they'll walk home. I said, I don't want people saying that about me. And so I called my doctor on the newspaper. He said, you can't do that. You get in your colon, you'll have to have emergency surgery. I said, I got to eat it a little. He said, cut it in a strip, roll it up in something like barbecue, chew it really slow. So that's what I did.
That's great. That's great. As a Patriots fan, I thought it was a fantastic time for CJ Stroud to have his best, have his worst game of the season, because the Patriots, if he didn't do that, the Patriots would not have gone to the Super Bowl this year. I do want to circle back on the offensive side, and I heard you say that we got to get CJ Stroud a run game. Do you think Woody Marks can be that guy in Houston, or do you think they have to go outside to find somebody else?
They drafted Woody Marks out of USC in the fourth round. They got him to be a change of pace back with Joe Mixon. Joe had played really well his first season here in 2024. Then he disappeared with a mysterious injury they would not talk about, they would not address. And so I just said he went into the witness protection program. I've since said he took a rocket ship to Mars with Elon Musk, because nobody's seen him. Nobody's talked to him. There's all kind of stuff on the internet. And I do not believe Joe Mixon will be back. And they can save $8.5 million by cutting him. I think they have to have a back. If not, they have a high second-round pick they got from Washington for Laremy Tunsil, plus a fourth-round pick. I think they need an offensive lineman in the first round, a back with that early pick in the second, another lineman when they use their pick in the second round. And then they worry about other things, but they have to improve that running game. Are they going to continue to give Stroud a disservice?
Yeah, I mean, they brought in Nick Chubb last year too, obviously. Coming off the knee injury, he's not the same player. He's older now, too. So they definitely need to find somebody else there, too. How did you feel Nick Caley did this year with Stroud in the offense?
Well, I tell you what, when he came in and they struggled early and went 0-3, he was getting crucified. And Bobby Slowick helped him go to the playoffs twice and win two playoff games. And he was D'Amico Ryan's close friend, and he had to fire him. And still don't know exactly why he did, but they did. They hired Caley. Caley had been with the Patriots for 10 years. He knew the offensive line coach, Cole Popovich. He'd been with Sean McVay for the previous 2 years. But he handled it very well. And I'll say it in Nick Caley's favor, he tried different things. He just didn't keep beating his head against the wall when something didn't work. He changed the blocking schemes. He changed players. But their offensive line has got to have some stability, and it lacks stability. And it's been a disservice to every quarterback they've had in there, and it'd be a shame to waste Stroud with that. But I thought Caley, a lot of people wanted him fired. You can't fire an offensive coordinator, two of them in a row. You'll never get a good one to come in here for the next one thinking he can be fired. So I thought ultimately during that winning streak that Caley did a pretty darn good job considering the limitations he worked with.
And just my last thought on the offensive side, they obviously have Nico Collins. But after that, a couple of guys like Noel and Higgins, do you see them taking the next step next year? Or do you think, again, we obviously know the offensive line is a massive problem for the Texans. Does he need more weapons in the receiving game as well to kind of get back to where he was, you know, a few years ago?
No, I don't see that as being a need. Jaden Higgins ended up making the all-rookie team. He had 6 touchdowns. They didn't throw the ball a lot.
Yeah.
They just didn't have the ball a lot on offense. They had so many 3-and-outs. Jalen Null, slot receiver, he had some big plays. He did the return game. Christian Kirk had been hurt most of the year. He came in, played really good at the end of the season, maybe auditioning for his next job. I don't know if they'll bring him back. Tank Dell, and I haven't figured this out, and I can tell you guys in about a year, if you got a little skinny bird legs, is it easier or harder to come back from multiple surgeries like he had for a broken leg? Now, he wanted to play this season. He's out there working his tail off every day, and he and Stroud are really tight. And if he could come back and be what he was when he got hurt in the 2024 season, it'd be like having an extra second-round pick But until we see him in a game get clobbered a few times, people are going to still hold their breath.
I completely forgot about Tank Dell, I'll be honest with you. But if he comes back and does that and gives that defense, which I think is the best unit in the league, look out for the Houston Texans. That's where I sit on it. Big fan of that defense down there.
Defense is very good, and it's well coached, and they're smart, and they're relentless, and they tackle well. I saw Ross Tucker several times going on and on about how they were the best tackling defense he'd seen. And they don't have a lot of dumb guys screwing up mentally. And they've got a really good secondary, great ends. They got four tackles whose contracts are up. They only need two to re-sign two of them. They're not going to cost much money. And they'll get around a defensive tackle at some point, but it better not be in the first two rounds.
Well, let me before I kind of hop on the defensive bandwagon conversation here, as someone who does have spindly legs and tore his ACL, I think it's a little bit harder if you have skinny legs versus really muscular legs when you're coming back. But I hope the best for Tank Dell. He's an explosive player.
He had skinny muscular legs.
Well, I'm skinny. I wouldn't go with the muscular. I agree with you guys on the defense. And to me, you know, it's actually interesting to me that Matt Burke doesn't get more in the conversation of being a head coach, because I mean, the guy's a terrific defensive mind, and you've seen that, after he had the opportunity to call plays on the defensive side. And if anyone who knows Matt Burke knows, he's got the personality to be a leader of an entire group. I want to ask you specifically about one person that we haven't spoken about, and John, you know, throughout all your decades of covering the NFL, you've probably seen some incredible cornerback play. I think that Caserio got a little bit of unwarranted heat early in Derek Stingley's career because he wasn't healthy. He was picked right before the Jets took Sauce Gardner, and Gardner obviously had a lot of early success, but he's kind of leveled off, whereas I think you're seeing Derek Stingley ascend as a player. In your estimation, is Derek Stingley the best cornerback in the NFL?
I can't say that he is, because I don't watch all of them. But that first year when he was a rookie, he missed 9 games. And he had been hurt at LSU every year since that great freshman year in 2019. And we're like, well, why take a guy that gets hurt every year? Now he's been healthy. And he makes one big play after another. And Kamari Lassiter, second-round pick from Georgia, he's a hell of a player too. Physical, Jalen Petrie and Kalen Bullock are safeties. Petrie covers the slot receivers. Those four guys are ballers. They're fast. They're physical. I'm surprised. Stingley's not undersized. He's stout, and so is Lassiter. Bullock is tall, 6'3", rangy. You know, I think Jalen Petrie plays around the line of scrimmage, and he's 195 pounds. And I can't believe the physicality that he plays with. He hasn't been hurt seriously. He missed a lot of the previous year, but that guy can play. But they're all kind of light. D'Amico Ryans wants his defense lighter and faster, and he gets that. And they were fortunate last year not to have serious injuries on defense like they'd had the year before.
I agree with you on Petrie. A wonderful player. I mean, just like, and it's a guy that a lot of people don't talk about. I mean, I'm sure down in Houston they do, but around the league, I mean, I think he's a terrific player. They just have, like you said, a lot of smart guys, not that many dumb guys. And sometimes in the NFL, that's really what it takes. You know, the mental mistakes really pile up and contribute to poor defensive play. And if you got a lot of guys who are heady, that can make a big difference, even if they aren't all the most athletic, fastest guys in the league.
When they get beat, it's because they've just gotten beat, not because they'll make a mental mistake. C.J. Johnson-Gardner cost him a game against Jacksonville. He kept wanting to play the way he wanted to play, not the way they wanted him to play, and he cost them the loss early in the season, and they immediately got rid of him.
I got two questions, John. One's football, one's not football. I'm going to save the not football one for the end. But the football-related one, you know, as we mentioned at the top of the show, this 2026 training camp will be your 50th, which is unbelievable. I mean, the fact that you've been around football for half a century is just mind-blowing to me, and I'm not a young guy. Is there one training camp story that you'd love to retell, something that really jumps out your time covering the Texans, the Oilers, you know, anything in the NFL?
The Oilers were a lot more fun because today players are so businesslike. You don't get to spend time with them like we used to. When I covered the Oilers, love you Blue Oilers, with Bum Phillips and Earl Campbell and Dan Pastorini. And my first training camp, they still played 6 preseason games, and they had a week for the rookies. So training camp was basically 7 weeks. They did full contact the first day on double days, and players didn't like it, and they swear, all of these guys, Dan Pastorini, Kenny Houston, Joe Green, say we had fewer injuries back then doing 2 practices a day for about 5 or 6 hours than they do today when they take it easy on them. And one time when we were, let's see, we were in San Angelo, Texas, way out in West Texas. Oilers trained out there for about 8 years. Mike Rozier was their best running back, the Heisman Trophy winner from Nebraska. And Mike liked to pull pranks on people. And so I stayed on a floor, the 10th floor, where they put ball boys and stuff. Most of the media stayed in motels, but I wanted to be able to wander the halls and down in the lobby and get to know people and talk to them off the record. And one time I hear this commotion and this screaming and yelling, and I'm like, is it a terrorist? What is up? So I ran from the end right by, I was by the stairs. I went down the stairs. It got louder. I got down to a floor where I hear screaming, and I realize it's the rookie floor. Mike Rozier had been somewhere and met somebody with a circus in town. And somehow he got this guy to bring his leopard, a leopard named Cowboy, to the training camp about midnight, right before curfew. And they get on an elevator and they go to the rookie floor. And it was Cowboy had a muzzle, but, you know, the doors open. Players are all sitting around watching an old black and white TV on the wall, and they turned Cowboy loose. Well, Cowboy was scared to death, and he ran out there, and the players are screaming, jumping on furniture, running down the halls. And I saw it, and I asked Rozier, was laughing his ass off, and the handler got Cowboy under control. I got a couple of quotes from Rozier, and I ran back down to my room, called in a story right before the last deadline at the Houston Chronicle at 12:30, dictated a story about Cowboy conquers Oilers, and it won an award for a short story on deadline.
Oh, that's great.
That's awesome. A great story.
You would definitely, you're right. You're definitely not going to get a story like that now around camp because of just how the rules have changed. I want to get you out on this. Anybody who doesn't know, John is a big Baylor guy. You know, he had mentioned earlier that he's from Waco, Texas. So anybody from Waco, Texas has to be asked this question simply because I'm a huge fan of these people. Have you asked Chip and Joanna Gaines to renovate your house at any point? And would you like
to? They don't come out of town. They do them in the Waco area. Okay. And I'll tell you this, I get asked all over the country if I know Chip and Joanna. And I don't, but I always tell the people that ask, usually women, I tell them they're great. Yes, I know them. They're great. And they go, oh, I'm so glad. Because friends of mine, they've redone their houses, say they both are great. And one time we were putting Gary Kubiak in the Texas Sports Hall of Fame in Waco, and his wife, Rhonda, called me, said, do you have any connections to get me into Chip and Joanna's place without me standing in line like everybody else? And I said, I do. So I called a friend of mine who they had redone his house, and he called him and said, be at this spot at this time, and I'll come out and get you and take you in. So I called Gary, and I said, Gary, by the way, I got a good friend who has a boat, wants to take you up and down the Brazos over by McLean Stadium where they sell gate. And he's got Coors Light like you like it. And he thanked me, and he's very sheepish. And I said, well, what are you going to do while Rhonda is over at Chip and Joanna's? And he's kind of, I said, oh, no, don't tell me. He said, yeah, I do kind of want to go over there. But don't you tweet that. So I've never tweeted it. And Gary and Rhonda got the personal tour. Chip and Joanna Gaines' place.
Yeah, it's funny. I covered Kelvin Beachum, who's a tackle for the Jets many years ago. He's currently a tackle for the Arizona Cardinals. His mom lives in Waco, and they actually had an episode where Chip and Joanna renovated Kelvin Beecham's mom's house.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I know they're typically just in the Waco area, but you're Mr. Waco. You're a sports legend. I mean, they should make an exception. And
if I was going to move somewhere and have a new house built, it wouldn't be to my hometown.
Well, this has been great. We had a great time. Be sure to check out John McClain's new documentary, PVL Story, A Separate But Equal with a question mark. It's on maddogentertainment.tv. As we said a few times earlier, it's a must watch if you love football, if you love history. Very insightful, in-depth reporting. I'm really glad that you had an opportunity to do this, Sean. We're so happy that you came on this podcast. Again, a giant in this industry, one of the best NFL reporters over the past two generations, which is remarkable to say about anybody. So we're really thankful, and we hope to have you on again. Thanks again. I don't know how many times I can say thanks, but I'm really appreciative.
It's my pleasure. Thank you guys very much for having me. Thank you for promoting the PVL Story, Separate But Equal. Anytime you need me, just let me know.
Will do. And you guys can check out Between the Tackles on YouTube, also on other social channels, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, X, at Tackles Pod. Make sure to download, like, and perhaps most importantly, subscribe if you like episodes like this. Until next time, for Burge, I'm Manish. We'll talk to you down the road.